right? Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. There's more oil on the casters than our seats. The court is pleased to return to South Texas College of Law to hear arguments. We were here in 2003, I think, and inaugurated this courtroom with the first oral arguments, and now we're back. We would like to thank the students and the faculty and the administration for making our stay here so pleasant, and we would especially like to thank the students for attending these arguments, because we believe that when you see the judiciary in action, the respect you have for the third branch of government is elevated, and you understand how complex some of the matters that are presented to this court for review are. So thank you for your attendance this morning. This morning we have two matters on our oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080175, Whirlpool Corporation versus Margarita Camacho and others from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 080262, Dr. Yamada versus Laura Friend individually and as personal representative of the estate of Sarah Elizabeth Friend, deceased, and Luther Friend individually, and that's from Tarrant County and the 2nd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take about a 15-minute recess between the two arguments. These arguments are being recorded, and we should have the arguments posted on our court's website by today or tomorrow. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080175, Whirlpool Corporation versus Margarita Camacho.
May it please the court, Ms. Liberato will present argument for the petitioner to preserve an agreement.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is a products case in which the plaintiff failed to provide reliable evidence of a design defect, failed to present reliable evidence of an alternative, safer design, and the manufacturer, Whirlpool, proved that the experts' theories were impossible. To set the scene, it's important to recall the steps that led to the experts' opinion that a piece of lint smaller than the tip of your finger could cause this massive house fire. What the plaintiff's experts contend is that there is a tube called a lint transport tube that, because it's corrugated, that caused lint to back up into a dryer cabinet, sucked up 6 inches into a heater box as it went past a heating element to become ignited, passed through a screen, go into the drum of the dryer. There it circulated with, it tumbled with those clothes for more than 10 minutes. And then sometime later, fueled those T-shirts to the point where they ignited and created a fire intense enough that it could escape the drum, could cause this massive house fire, and at the same time, not destroy it. The difficulty in this case that the plaintiff's experts have is that there are numerous steps in the process to get to their conclusion, this tiny piece of lint could cause this massive.
Well, Ms. Liberato, there is some evidence in the record from the CPSC report, which I believe your brief says is prejudicial. But you know, what purpose do reports serve other than be prejudicial to one side or the other? And there is some evidence of an alternative design So why isn't that sufficient for the jury to make a decision?
It's a good question, and the answer is really a two-part question. Number one is that that evidence isn't reliable because it's not close enough to serve as a reliable basis to give the expert a foundation to be able to testify about this. But I think also it's important to step back and look at just what the CPSC report shows, what the other evidence that they say makes this expert's testimony reliable. Even if one accepts that that evidence is enough to make this testimony reliable, it only shows or could show that lint can burn, that if lint is targeted at another piece of lint, that it can cause another, you know, that piece of lint to ignite. And then the other thing is that lint can accumulate in the dryer, inside the dryer. That's all it shows. It doesn't show all the other steps that have to take place. There's no evidence, for example, that a piece of lint this small can be sucked up into the dryer box. There's no evidence that it can that it won't self-extinguish. There's no evidence.
What weight, if any, does the evidence from the parents that were there and the witnesses to this fire? They testified that there was fire coming from or around this dryer. Does that have any weight?
It doesn't because it's lay testimony. But even assuming, and a lay testimony can't be used to prove causation when it's necessary for there to be an expert. But again, there's nothing inconsistent with that testimony with what our view is, and that is that it is certainly possible, and well, actually, we believe that our expert testified that the fire started in that area around the dryer. But the fact of the matter is that that Ms. Camacho's testimony that fire was coming from the dryer is still not sufficient to support the reliability of the expert.
And lay testimony can provide facts that experts can base their opinions on, however. So if the lay testimony is that the fire was coming out of the drum of the dryer, couldn't an expert use that as a basis for an opinion?
If he or she tests that, because even if there were fire coming out of the dryer, that's not enough to show there was a product defect. And there has to, or design defect, what the claim is. There has to be each part of the link in the chain, and this is where there's an analytical gap, if we're applying an analytical gap test, that there are gaps in the theory that keep that show that this expert's testimony is reliable.
You rely a lot on the testability. I know that a lot of the briefing goes to the testability factor of the Robinson test. But how would you test this? How would you? I mean, the argument's made that you can't recreate a fire triangle in the same manner that was present, perhaps, on the day of the accident. How would you test it?
Well, the way that Whirlpool tests. I think what the argument is, Judge, is that you can't recreate exactly what happened under those exact circumstances. And that's probably true in any situation. You're not going to be able to test it exactly. But you break down these steps, and there are tests that can be performed on each one of these. And, in fact, that's what Whirlpool did. Whirlpool tested lint and ignited it and showed that it self-extinguishes. It tested whether...
But wasn't there evidence in the CPSC report that shows that may not be the case? That it cannot self-extinguish in some circumstances? I mean, each piece seems to find some support in the CPSC report, each piece of the testing.
It does not. The CPSC report, let me distinguish that in just a second, but let me directly answer the question of what the CPSC shows and the steps that it doesn't take care of. CPSC had a lint accumulation test. And what that showed is that lint can accumulate in a dryer. The second thing was...
Okay, and that's similar here because we have some evidence that lint accumulated in this dryer from a photograph.
We do, and Whirlpool doesn't dispute that it is possible and that probably likely that there will be some small amount of lint.
I just want, as you break it down, I want to see if there's evidence in the record to support each piece.
Well, if I may, then I'll go, if I could, I'll go step by step. So the first thing that has to happen is that this tiny piece of lint has to be sucked up 6 inches into the heater box. And there's no test that shows that by the plaintiff's experts, but there are repeated tests by Whirlpool's experts to show that can happen. The next step in the process.
And the CPSC dryers were different, so right. That doesn't establish one way or the other for this dryer.
Well, that's right, Judge, but I have to say I'm just giving total benefit of the doubt to the CPSC report, and you're absolutely right. It's a different dryer. It's a different configuration. They're disassembled pieces. It's horizontal. The test is done so that the lint's traveling horizontally rather than vertically. So it is very different. But in going back to the steps, what has to happen next, and once it gets sucked up, it has to go past the heating element. And it is roaring past there in milliseconds. And we have tests that show that can't happen. It can't. It cannot ignite because it's just plain moving too fast across that heating element. So there's no evidence to that effect. The CPSC report, going back to Judge Brister's comment, in that case, the test is the lint is moving very, very slowly, half the speed, across. And again, as I said, across the heating element, and as I said, it's going horizontal.
And why do the plaintiffs in their brief and in citation to the record say that the report demonstrates the dryer's heater can turn airborne lint into embers that ignite material downstream?
I think that's true.
Okay. I thought you just said that it was going too fast to ignite.
In our case, but that's the difference, and that's part of the point is that why the CPSC report does not provide reliable evidence for their expert, because in that case it's moving so slowly as opposed to ours, which is going twice as fast, and ours is going up rather than across. So yes, it shows that can happen, but it's lint, igniting lint, it's a different configuration, different pieces from a different
not similar conditions is your position.
Sorry?
Not similar conditions is your position.
Not similar conditions, not similar mechanics.
What about the expert's testimony that there were pieces of lint that he believed were found on or under the heating element on this particular dryer?
Well, he ended up recanting that on the Whirlpool dryer. That's correct. On the Whirlpool dryer. And this dryer was in an inferno, and the house was burning.
But if the lint is going by too fast, is his testimony some evidence that pieces of lint could become lodged in the dryer, in the heating element, I mean?
There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of that.
But am I misreading the record or misremembering it where I thought there was a reference that he testified in this dryer, the heating element had evidence of lint still in it was burned.
Not the heating element. The heating element didn't have lint.
Okay.
But that is a good jumping off point, Your Honor, to talk about the other pieces of the other steps that weren't proven by the plaintiffs, because that's where we were last. To me, one of the most compelling, just as a layperson, is the fact that there's no test, and defies logic, frankly, but putting that aside, I know that's not the test the court considers, that these two T-shirts can tumble for more than 10 minutes, not extinguish this ember. There's no test that the plaintiff's experts undertook to show that. We showed that it could not happen, and then that these T-shirts could fuel a fire that would be strong enough and intense enough to escape the drum of the dryer, but not burn up the T-shirts.
Now, there's some discussion by one of the experts on for the Camachos that he did some testing and he came up with a conclusion based on some testing and his common sense. How is that ever tested for reliability? How's some expert's common sense tested? How does that play here?
Well, I common sense to me is almost that
it's speculation, it's a hunch, conjecture.
Say so is another way Christopher put it in an opinion. That's what common sense is. But that's no evidence. I mean, what the cases require, they require testing, they require, if it can be tested, this is scientific, this is this is testable. Whirlpool showed it was testable. But under any circumstance, there needs to be objective standards by which the experts base their opinions.
Is there in the evidence of burn patterns that show that the fire originated in the dryer's drum or not?
No. Now, the expert that testified, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but what our expert said is that there had to be burn patterns on the outside to show it escaped, and there weren't. Also testified that it was commonly accepted that the top half of the drum would be burned, but not the bottom half. And so there wasn't reliable expert testimony by the plaintiff's case.
Now, Whirlpool, as I understand it, believes that the fire began under the floor of the laundry room. And the plaintiffs say that the fire began in the dryer, exited the dryer, and caused the fire that burned the trailer and killed the young man. If the fire began under the floor, I think there's in the briefing some citation to evidence that the bottom of the floor and this elevated trailer floor was burned more intensely than the top of the floor, the side that you would normally walk on in a trailer. I think I remember reading evidence about that. However, there was a 2.5 by 2.5 foot square that was not burned. I guess that was under the dryer, as I understand it. If the fire began under the floor, wouldn't it burn that square as well? Now, if the fire began on top of the floor, then the dryer would protect it. But if the fire began under the floor, I guess the dryer sitting in that square would provide some protection, but wouldn't there still be some burning in that square if the fire began under the floor?
Well, what the expert testified, and actually what the evidence showed, is that there was some ductwork underneath the dryer, and that's what burned. And what he testified is that ambient or radiant heat, what you call it, the radiant heat is what burned the underneath side, burned both that ductwork and underneath flooring. So the top of the flooring wasn't burned. So the evidence is consistent with coming from the bottom. But I think it's that's an important point that, and as I know the court knows, it's not our burden to show what the alternative explanation is. And now from a juror standpoint, juries are going to want to know if Whirlpool's product didn't do it, then what did?
So I'm wondering if the parties could agree that there are only three ways it remotely could happen, and all three were sort of equally unlikely. Where does that leave the jury?
Well, I think not the jury. I think the judge, because the judge would be determining if the expert was reliable and could testify.
Shouldn't you let the evidence in if there's A, B, and C. Everybody agrees either it was gasoline under the floor, or it was something else, it was an electrical outlet or extension cord, or it was the dryer. And everybody says, well, it's a very small chance it was either any one of those. Doesn't the judge have to let it in?
No, Your Honor, because the plaintiff has the burden to rule in, not just rule out. And that's kind of a similar circumstance. You don't cases in this area say you cannot just give these three options and, you know, sort of like, okay, jury, you pick, that before any evidence goes in, that the plaintiff has the burden of showing that there is reliable evidence to support their theory of why, in our case, the dryer was decided.
Let me clarify one thing. Are you saying that the plaintiff's experts should not have been allowed to take the stand at all to say anything, or that what they said was simply amounted to no evidence?
I'm saying that they shouldn't be allowed to have taken the stand at all, and that it amounted, or because it amounted to no evidence.
Now, does Texas recognize a negligence spoliation claim as you've asserted here?
There is Court of Appeals authority for a negligence spoliation. But, Judge, I think we have intentional spoliation because the evidence is, and what the plaintiff's experts did, is so reckless that it rises to the level of intentional.
Now, whose duty is that? Is that the duty of the homeowner to notify all parties they think may be responsible? Is it the duty of an expert? Or who has that burden?
Well, in this case, it's the duty of counsel or the duty of the expert, but I think duty of counsel, who was hired immediately. The experts were hired within 2 days, and an exemplar dryer was bought within 36 hours. And so clearly the dryer was the target almost from the start. So under the guidelines, the National Fire Association, National Fire Prevention Association guidelines, there's a duty to notify Whirlpool immediately once they knew that they were a target. I mean, it's consistent with our jurisprudence, which is that you preserve evidence if there is an anticipation of litigation. Certainly, there was an anticipation.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that on rebuttal and how that may have impacted your case.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. The court's analysis of this case should be driven by its most recent fire causation expert case, which was Mack Trucks versus Thomas, decided 3 years ago. In that case, the expert on fire causation was excluded by the trial court, and this court held that that was not an abuse of discretion. But in its opinion, this court pointed out several things that this expert should have done in order to present reliable testimony on fire causation.
Same expert, right?
I'm sorry?
Same expert, right?
The same expert as in this case?
As in Thomas?
No.
Different
expert, Your Honor. I think his name was Elbron, something like that. Had nothing to do with this case. And in that case, this court laid out five or six things that he should have done in order to provide reliable evidence. Each one of those things was done by the expert in this case. According to the Thomas decision, if that's what you have to do to be reliable, then this expert was reliable. The court said in that case that he should have referred to studies and tests. And in our case, the expert relied on the CPSC study and tests that he did himself, that Don Russell from Texas A&M did, and also looked at Whirlpool tests.
Now, I haven't read the entire CPSC study, but where in the study does it talk about the speed that precludes it from being sucked up into the dryer before it's extinguished?
It doesn't talk about the speed specifically, Your Honor. It says that the wind can ignite either when it comes into contact with the heating element or with its, I think it's within 3 inches of the heating element. So it doesn't have to actually land, collide with the heating element in order to ignite. And they said that it could ignite. And of course, the other evidence we have of that is that in this case, both the Exemplar dryer and the Camacho's dryer had evidence of charred lint. So that's concrete physical evidence that lint can ignite in and around the heating element.
Now, the Exemplar dryer, I didn't see anything in the record. How was that obtained? How was that chosen, the Exemplar dryer?
I was wondering about that myself, and I don't know, except that our investigator somehow maybe went to dealers in the area, but he somehow...
It was a heavily used dryer.
The Exemplar dryer?
Right. It wasn't brand new.
No. No, and neither was the Camacho's dryer. And this dryer was, and I don't know how he found it, but he somehow found the identical Easy Clean 100 dryer and obtained it.
Was there evidence about other fires or claims of fires related to the Easy Clean 100 one way or the other?
There wasn't one way or the other. And one of the things that Whirlpool says repeatedly in its brief is that we're not aware of any fires ever caused by lint ignition in an Easy Clean 100. Of course, they don't think this one was. And if they took that attitude towards every lawsuit, they would always be able to say that.
We just don't know. What
we just don't know. And we didn't try to offer evidence because of this court's decisions and other products cases saying that evidence of other failures by that product is not relevant. So there's no evidence one way or the other.
Mr. DuBose, in the petitioner's brief, Exhibit D, there's a photo, looks like, of the back of a dryer with the rear panel removed. Is that the Easy Clean dryer or an Easy Clean dryer like the one at issue in this case?
I don't know. I would imagine it's either the Camacho's dryer or the Exemplar dryer, but I think it is an Easy Clean dryer.
I'm having a hard time understanding what this piece of lint did to cause the fire. It went from a lint chute across the heater box. Can you just tracked with this diagram or one that you have that you think may be better. What happened? Because I'm having a hard time following.
I can, Your Honor. And first of all, it's important to note that it wasn't necessarily one tiny piece of lint. It could have been multiple pieces of lint or embers, and not there's never any requirement.
What did the lint or family of lints do?
But the lint came through the lint chute. The lint is generated by the dryer process in the drum. There's a lint chute that goes to an exhaustus and is supposed to go out the back of the dryer.
Okay.
There's evidence that lint sometimes leaks out of the lint chute and goes into the back cabinet of the dryer, which is where the heating element is. And because the EZ-Clean 100 has an air ventilation system that they're very proud of, it causes lint to be airborne once it gets into that system. If it's in proximity to the heating element, then it ignites. It then migrates from there into the drum.
Okay, let me stop you there. So lint comes from the dryer drum into the lint chute assembly.
Right.
There's an exhaust vent there. It's supposed to come out there, but it may leak because there may be a space between the lint chute assembly and the back of the dryer.
Right.
Then the lint goes, in this case, went up to the top of the heater box and into that heater box and was ignited, went back into the dryer drum and ignited the fire?
It didn't necessarily go into the heating element itself, but when it comes in proximity to it, it ignites, and then it goes from there into the drum and ignites.
Would the piece of lint have had to, in your theory, entered the heater box before going back into the drum of the dryer?
There's a cabinet on the back of the dryer. If that entire thing is what we're referring to as the heater box, yes. It didn't have to enter the heating element itself.
Wait a minute. Say that again. Isn't there, in the photograph, as I understand, there's a covering over the heating element. It shows a covering. It doesn't show a heating element.
Right. So that's what I'm saying, is it wouldn't have to come up against the heating element itself if it's in proximity to the heating element.
If it's outside that metal covering,
right,
and protected from the heating element itself,
right,
there's testimony and evidence that is enough to ignite it.
There is, Your Honor, and again, it's
and then it would, if even if it's outside the heating element, it can be blown into the drum.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the CPSC report indicated that if it's just within 3 inches of the heating element, the heat alone can cause it to ignite.
So if it's outside the heating element, how does it, and it ignites there, or it starts burning there, how then does it get from there into the drum?
There's a space between the back cabinet that flows to the drum, and because of the design of the EZ-Clean 100, they constantly circulate air through the dryer. So it is then circulated, it ignites, and then goes into the drum.
Through what opening or through what item does the lint go from the back cover of the dryer back into the drum?
I can't tell you exactly, Your Honor, but I know that there's an opening between the back cabinet and the drum, and that's how the lint migrates.
But it doesn't have to be blown in there by this fast-moving current of air that council's talking about. Is that your position? It can just kind of migrate in there. It doesn't have to be blown in there through the air force.
The EZ-Clean 100 dryer has a system that circulates air throughout the dryer, and that causes the lint to be airborne and to flow through the dryer system.
Were your experts able to duplicate this in any type of lab testing?
Or any other expert?
They did a lint ignition test. It wasn't identical to these conditions. The CPSC did test to show
that. That was where they dropped lint on a heating element.
That's right.
That's a little different.
That's right, and what that shows is that when you drop it on the heating element, it actually comes into contact with it. But the CPSC report showed that it ignited within 3 inches of it, so you don't have to have actual contact.
The speed it's moving past makes a difference.
It does, and
when it goes past at the speed of sound, it's not going to ignite.
It does make a difference, Your Honor, but there hasn't been any real qualification of what the outer limits are of that. My understanding of the whirlpool testing, they're talking about the flow of air through the lint chute itself. According to Whirlpool's theory, there is no lint in the back cabinet at all. I don't know how you measure the speed of something that's not even supposed to be there. But it was back there, and we know that again because we found burnt lint.
And then get to the part that Ms. Liberato says is the hardest for her to understand. It's the embers tossing around with wet T-shirts, and it ignites them but doesn't really flame, and then it stops. And then your clients, did she open the door and discovered the flames, or the flames were coming out when she walked in the laundry room?
She walked by the laundry room and opened the door and then walked away from the laundry without looking inside. And
so
then
no flames then?
Right, right. And then shortly thereafter, she noticed smoke. And then
shortly thereafter being how long? Was there evidence that the dryer was off for 30 minutes or something like that? Is that correct?
There's not clear-cut evidence about that, Your Honor. Let me talk about that important, because that's important. And I'm going to come back to your question, Justice Brewster. The Whirlpool seizes upon a statement that Ms. Camacho apparently made to an investigator at some point, that she thought she started the dryer at 10 o'clock. She said at trial she doesn't remember ever saying that, doesn't remember talking to someone. She didn't have a watch on that night. She has no idea what time it was, except that from the time she opened the dryer until she smelled smoke, it was not very long.
Husband said she started washing clothes at 10:30 p.m.
Well, not right? quite. It wasn't her husband. It was her son.
Her son.
And what he
okay.
said is, I went to sleep at 10:30, and at that point, she had not started the washing.
Now, that's a trial, right?
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
And that's, to me, this is one of the most troubling parts. What they told the investigators immediately after the fire was that the husband had boarded up the son's window, and that it had been several hours after she opened it before flames started happening. Then we hire experts, and we come to trial, and all of that changes. Now, in that kind of situation, a court should be especially concerned about reliability and spoliation, shouldn't we?
I think what that means, when you have conflicting testimony like that,
this isn't conflicting witness. This is the same people who told one story to the fire investigators, and then after a suit was filed and their investigators come back and said what caused the fire, they changed their testimony. A court has to be concerned about that, don't we?
And I think what the court does is it allows the jury to hear both parts of that testimony, and then they get to decide. And according to City of Keller versus Wilson, that's what you do. When there's conflicting testimony, whether it's from the same witness or not, the jury gets to make that decision.
Not always. A lot of times we don't allow witnesses to change the testimony. And there's policy reasons for that, and especially when everything's been destroyed, moved around, et cetera, which may be the fireman's fault, may not be your client's fault at all.
Okay.
But it's at some point, don't we have to be concerned about this? I mean, we could just toss them all to the jury, of course, toss all credibility questions, and we generally do. But when we're talking about millions and millions of dollars and testimony has changed this much, should there be any heightened reliability we require? Shouldn't that factor in?
First of all, I don't think the testimony has changed that much. Most of the testimony was remarkably consistent. There was this difference between Ms. Macho's testimony about the timing. But I think it would be a dangerous rule where you say, when there's a conflict, we're going to give binding, conclusive effect to an investigator's statement. That investigator never even testified. His statement was admitted to evidence, handwritten notes from his testimony. That gets conclusive effect, and you disregard the sworn testimony of the witness.
And shouldn't there be some weight given to a person who has suffered this very traumatic event with the loss of a child and the course of loss of all their possessions, and you know, making statements in a very traumatic situation like that, and then later on, for whatever reason, you have time to reflect on things, and perhaps you recall things differently or more specifically. I mean, certainly there has to be some weight given to that.
I certainly think there is, Your Honor.
That would wipe out the excited utterance rule, wouldn't it?
Yeah. This wasn't an excited utterance. And excited utterance rule has other causes.
So how does your client prevail if the CPS C report is excluded for whatever reason, and relying only on the testimony of your expert who did some testing and looked at some other documents and then came to the conclusion that this was the cause of the fire based on that study and his common sense? How does that support the verdict?
Well, first of all, I don't think the CPSC report should be excluded, and that's not really argued in the briefing before this court. It was a test undertaken by an impartial government body before this fire ever occurred. It came about because of concern about, in 1998, there were 15,600 dryer fires thought to be attributable to lint ignition in this country. So they did a study of Lent ignition. It's not some fanciful theory that our expert came up with. It's in this impartial government agency came up with this study. So I don't think it should be disregarded.
I'm curious, how many of those 15,600 fires occurred in an easy clean dryer?
The report doesn't attempt to quantify that, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we certainly aren't making that point.
But your expert and no other expert has ever been able to replicate a fire in this model dryer.
Our expert has not, in a complete dryer, replicated this fire. That's exactly correct.
Did he attempt to? Do you know?
I don't know that he did any tests using the complete dryer. But again, I don't think that should be the standard, because a lot of defective products have caused problems that can't always be replicated. If there was litigation about the space shuttle, for example, that had been tested many times. That O-ring problem had never occurred, and yet we know that that failed because of the defect.
It's a little hard to do tests with a giant rocket. It's expensive before long.
It is.
Whereas this case, your clients were, what did they ask the jury to award? The jury awarded $14 million. They asked, I assume, more than that? Or?
I don't remember, Your Honor.
So it's worth doing some testing, given the amount of money involved. And I'm interested in the argument. That does make sense to me. There may be so many coincidences have to happen that it'd be hard to replicate. But then, if that's true, doesn't that reflect on the question of whether this was an unreasonably dangerous defect? If it's so hard, you can never make it happen again in a test, how could it be unreasonably dangerous?
If it's a defect that can cause a problem of this nature, and again, it's not an isolated incident. Apparently, these dryer fires are fairly
but
common.
I'm assuming at some point, if there's a 1 in a billion chance or 1 in a trillion, one would have to say that's not unreasonably dangerous because it's just so rare.
I think that's right. If it's
well,
that
if
remote,
you can't
maybe,
do it. With lots of trying, how could it still be unreasonably dangerous?
Well, certainly there's not that kind of quantification. But again, unreasonably dangerous is something that we leave up to a jury. They get to decide how dangerous it is, how often it happens, and they make that decision.
Let me touch on an aspect of this case that I think is particularly interesting, and that is what you have to prove to show an alternative safer design. And there are arguments been made that we should apply the same Robinson factors to expert testimony of a safer alternative design. And there's some appeal to that. It seems awfully easy for somebody to say, well, you should have put a glass tube, a smooth tube, and without really testing the efficacy of that sort of fix. And how do you answer that charge?
Your Honor, that exact argument was made before this court in a case called GMC versus Sanchez in 1999. There was an argument made that the safer alternative design in that case didn't have testing, didn't follow the Daubert standards. And this court, first of all, said that there was more to just this theory than just the expert's bald assertion. He described the operation of the product, the proposed design that would make it safer, and that his testimony about engineering principles underlying his proposed design supports his conclusion. But more importantly, the court said that the plaintiffs did not have to build and test an automobile transmission to provide a safer alternative design.
I realize that. You don't have to duplicate it, but it does seem fairly easy in this situation to play armchair quarterback and kind of say glass tube when their internal testing had shown that glass tubes have problems as well. And I'm trying to figure out where that standard should be between perhaps Robinson and just bald assertions of an expert of something that might be apparently a fix, but that really after thousands and tens of thousands of tests doesn't work.
It wasn't a glass tube, it was a smooth tube, and the theory is really quite simple. This corrugated tube has...
No, I understand the supposed simplicity of the theory, but
right.
Which begs the question, if it's so simple, surely they would have done it.
Well, in fact, they did do it, and that's one of the things that helps the safer alternative design analysis. This is not some crazy idea, it's something that Whirlpool used to do. They changed their design, not because the tube was or was not accumulating lint, but because of a faulty connection at the transmission point, which is where the leak occurred.
Which is why I don't understand why the corrugated design would be a better design. If the problem is that the lint leaks out into the cabinet, the corrugated design is what was designed to prevent that from happening, so that because it gives it a flexibility that the straight tube wouldn't have. So why would then, if the problem is leaking lint into the cabinet of the dryer, why would you say that the straight tube would be a better design when it's been proved, at least by Whirlpool, that that does end up in some leaking into the cabinet?
Whirlpool's expert testified that that problem was solved, not by the change of tube, but by a better connection, an extra bracket and a couple of screws. That solved the problem with leakage. So there's no testimony that they had any problem with the glass, the smooth tube being part of the leakage.
What's the evidence of why they changed the tube to a smooth, to a corrugated tube then?
That's not really clear. They just said, we used to do this, we had this leakage problem, so we fixed that with the brackets and we changed the tube.
Mr. DeBose, before your time's up, can you touch on the spoliation issue and how that may impact this case?
Can, Your Honor. First of all, this is not a case of spoliation. Spoliation is where there is intentional destruction of evidence, and that's not what happened.
Now, there's an argument that it was so blatant, should have done this, that, and the other, that the negligence rises. That negligence rises to a higher standard, and it's almost the same as having an intentional conduct here, and I can't see that from the record. So can you?
Right, and it's this is not a case where evidence was destroyed. The evidence was meticulously preserved. The real complaint here is that it is about fire site investigation protocol, and that has never been recognized by any court in this state as a legal standard that requires you to invite every potential defendant to a fire scene before you do an investigation. Now, in this case, it's true that by the second day, we had identified Whirlpool as a possible defendant, but the experts said there were a number of other defendants. If you had a case where someone came home to a fire and they weren't there and didn't see it coming out of the dryer, and you had multiple appliances in the house, would you have to invite every one of them before you do any scene investigation? But of course, the other important thing about spoliation is there's no evidence that it hindered their experts at all. One of them was asked specifically if it precluded him from reaching conclusions. He said it didn't, and none of the experts did. So, and there's case law from in Slovenia, the court says sometimes in design defect cases, spoliation really doesn't impact your ability to defend against a design defect. So I don't think there was any harm, even if there was spoliation, and there wasn't spoliation.
Justice Hay.
Just quickly, the petitioner says that it's undisputed that the ember circulated with the clothes in the drum, and I know you dispute the timing, and there's a question about that, but do you agree with that part?
I missed the point that it was undisputed, that there were embers in the drum.
And circulated with the clothes for at least 10 minutes.
That's probably true because of the cool-down period. And, of course, by that point in the dry cycle, we're not talking about wet clothes. We're talking about fairly dry clothes. But, again, the CPSC report proved that embers, that lint could ignite and migrate downstream and not only ignite other lint, but ignite clothing. In fact, in the CPSC report, they used terry cloth towels, which I think would be harder to catch fire than a T-shirt. And they found the lint ignited terry cloth towels downstream.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Several things that have come up, but one thing that I think would be Wainwright's question about how the system works, and it sounds a little bit complicated, but it's a lot easier to understand when you look at the testimony and in the electronic brief that you filed. One of the first footnotes actually has diagrams supported by the testimony. And the working, how it works, isn't disputed. And it shows just what happens within the dryer and how the lint would travel and how, what the mechanics inside the dryer are. So, for example, Judge Wainwright asked, how does the piece of lint get out of the heater box into the drum? It gets there through a screen. And the reason the screen's important is that the screen is like, the little holes in the screen are half inch, and so we know, and that's why their expert agrees, and we know that the lint had to be so tiny. So
is that the lint screen I have to clean out every time?
Pardon me?
Is that the lint screen I have to clean out every time?
Well, there's a lint basket at the other end of the process, and that's what has to be cleaned out. Your Honor, I don't know how much laundry you do, but...
You'd be surprised.
Probably not. But, yeah, ultimately it's caught in a lint collection basket, and that's shown in this process.
How much does the plaintiff have to eliminate other possible causes of the fire or sources? Do they have to completely eliminate them? Is it if they say it's 60% likely that it was the dryer, even though they acknowledge that there are other possible causes? What's the standard there?
Well, they do have to eliminate other causes.
To a certainty, or to what extent?
I would say not to a certainty, and I haven't thought this through entirely, but that they have to limit them to a reasonable amount. But that the more important thing than eliminating the other causes is to rule in what the cause is. And that's our bigger complaint here. That there isn't enough reliable evidence to rule in causes, even though we would say they didn't rule out the causes. But here you don't even get there, and I know I'm not answering your question directly in a satisfactory way. I'm just not sure. But I do know that it has to be ruled in.
Let me try this one, Ms. Liberato. You seem to be arguing most kind of fervently that the testing, the examples given by their side, are just too dissimilar from this. But how similar? How close do the examples have to be to your exact product for us to give them weight?
I think they have to be substantially similar. That doesn't mean they have to be exact, but these particular tests are just not close enough. They don't fit, if you will, I would say substantially similar.
Can you define substantially similar?
Close enough to make it reliable. And I realize I'm going in circles. But here, they're so far away, and I know the court needs to, and that's part of its role is to set standards that apply. But in this case, they're just so far away. I mean, my goodness, the tests of on the CPSC of holding the lint over the heater box is like roasting a marshmallow over a bonfire. That's not what happened here. It's not even close. But I don't want to get lost in answering y'all's questions in the fact that even if everything these tests they say are true, that they present reliable evidence, that's still not enough because there's so many steps in the process for which the CPSC report, the exemplar dryer, the testimony of the lay witness, Ms. Camacho, still do not support that reliability. So we have no reliability on numerous of the steps. And I'm not talking about one step or two step or three step. I'm talking about a bunch of steps for which there is absolutely zero evidence, not reliable or unreliable, but zero evidence to support those steps.
Thank you, Ms. Liberato. Justice Johnson.
Briefly,
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
How was the alleged spoliation harmful to your client?
It was harmful because it prevented us from being able to show alternative causes. I know we don't have that burden of doing it.
Whose testimony or evidence do you rely on for that?
Well, we rely on evidence that the T-shirts were tested and have gasoline in them.
Does some witness for you testify that their investigation was impeded because of the alleged spoliation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who is that?
I believe that was Mr. Adams, John Adams.
Okay.
If I may add to that just real quickly, there is in the evidence, and it's really dramatic. Again, it helps to have to click on the footnote that showed, not the footnote, but click on this evidence. It shows what the scene looked like when their experts were done, which has a lot going on, and then whenever our experts were there when it's swept clean. Thank you for allowing me the extra time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Liberato. That cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All right.